I'm Alan Stolberg with Revival Cycles, and you're listening to the Ride and Talk podcast with Andy Dukes.
Thanks, Alan, and greetings to all of you out there. There are some amazing BMW builds that have taken shape in Alan's head and come to life in the Revival workshop. Among them, the awe-inspiring Birdcage that showcased the big boxer engine prototype that would later find its way onto the R18. We're going to discuss a few of these builds later in this podcast, but first, let's meet the man himself and find out where it all began. Alan Stolberg, welcome to Ride and Talk. Great to have finally nailed you down as a guest slot on the show.
Thank you very much. Sorry I'm hard to pin down.
That's fine. It'll be worth it, I'm sure. But I'm really not sure where to start. We could spend a whole podcast and more even on any one of your builds, but I guess it's worth starting right at the beginning, or your early days at least. Who gave you your love of motorcycles, and how young were you when you first slung your leg over one?
You're going to laugh. I just kind of got chills when you asked me that question, which I never do. It was my dad, right? Because I can channel myself right back to that moment at 5 years old that I first, it might have been earlier, frankly. My dad said that in diapers, and I do remember this distinctly, sitting on my dad's vintage Triumph that he had restored. You know, I say vintage, it was only like from the 60s at that point, and this would have been like at late 70s, so maybe it was 10 years old, but one that he'd bought wrecked and had modified. And I can remember it sitting on the center stand and me sitting on the seat, revving the throttle, and the bike, I remember the smell, and I remember the bike like shifting and shaking and moving around on the pavement. So yeah, it started then. And then my first bike was when I was 5 years old, where they bought me my brother and I a little Honda monkey bike that we learned to ride on in a horse field. And it was fantastic. Yeah, addictive, totally.
Absolutely know what you're talking about. So did you also have a curiosity for how things worked and were put together, you know, right from a young age as well? And I guess also a desire to take them apart, modify, and even improve them.
Yeah, I did. You know, I'm told from the very beginning that I was a button-pushing, you know, kid who liked to use tools and take things apart. But yeah, I do remember some of my earliest curiosities regarding, we would oftentimes get machines that were broken, right? To start with. So like my first motorcycle was a Honda and that thing didn't break. Well, actually take that back. My brother broke it the first day, by running it into a horse fence and cracking the headlight, which he'll never live down, my twin brother. Because he didn't use the brakes, which is hysterical in and of itself. But having to fashion the headlight back onto the motorcycle somehow so that I could continue riding it, and feeling very crushed by the fact that my somewhat brand new Honda, and it wasn't brand new, but it was new enough and untouched, had been damaged. So having to fasten that back together and always looking at the fact that it was dented from there on out was tough. But also then later getting from whether friends or my dad or whatever, my first dirt bike that was solely mine was broken when I got it, meaning the top end was seized on a two-stroke Suzuki the day I got it. So to ride it, you had to fix it. And I think it was a practical thing because we didn't have much money, but it was a smart thing for my dad to do because then I was determined to figure out a way to fix it. So yeah, it started early.
Curiosity and frustration, two of the best things you can leave your kids with. So even though you love bikes, you ended up following, shall we say, a more conventional career path. I think you worked in tech or software, something like that, before having like a light bulb moment that this wasn't what you wanted from your life. So what were the events that led up to you founding Revival Cycles?
Well, disenfranchisement, being completely disenfranchised with my career path, or, you know, what I'd chosen was the real moment. But, you know, I excelled in school until I got old enough to realize it was more of an abstract thing. It wasn't really practical. In high school is when I figured out that, I was bored essentially. And when I was told to go to college by my family, I didn't really know why. Like they told me why, but I didn't understand. I didn't feel why. So I struggled through college all through my 20s before I finally, you know, I would have a job, and I worked a lot of different jobs in a lot of different sectors, from finance to marketing to even like heavy machinery. I did body work. I did lots of different things in my 20s, but I went back to school, finished my degree in business and finance, and then got a job working for a software company that I loved, and it was the best job I'd ever had. I got fired for saying the wrong things to the wrong people, but being truthful, but certainly not playing the corporate game very well. And it sent me into a spiral because it was my favorite thing in the world. And I realized that I just couldn't have someone else in charge of what I was going to do. And I'm not trying to be meaningful or overly deep at all. It really was only in hindsight do I realize how desperate I was to make sure that I didn't have someone determining my destiny or completely in control of it. I mean, you never really get away from that. You're still at the mercy of the markets or of clients or of trends or, you know, all sorts of things, right? But I at least feel some level of control in my life, and that was what I was after. And so in 2008, after I'd been fired, I got on my motorcycle, rode it to New York City, then flew with it to London, actually, rode all over Europe for 7 months, and decided to come back and get to work and start up a company called Revival. That was
nothing like a road trip to sort your head out.
Yeah, and, you know, it was so cliche at the point, right? Like, and there were people in my family and people in my life that were like, "You've lost it," or maybe you never really had it. I'm not even being dramatic. Like, it really was. I had some sit downs with some important people in my life that thought that I was running from my problems. And to me, at the time, it was like the only thing I knew to run towards my problems, to get away from any influence that I had had in my life prior to that point. I mean, here, I was 30 years old, man. I wasn't a kid, you know, and I still needed to be alone. So, yeah, I formulated a plan and talked to every single person I knew that could help me grasp how to move forward with that plan or change that plan, which I did 1,000 times. But really, ultimately, it was just about getting to work, accepting the fact that things were not going to be ideal from the get-go, and working through problems one at a time to try to build something.
At that time, what were your ambitions exactly? I mean, what did you want out of it, or what did you think it might lead to? And was it about more than just motorcycles?
You know, yeah, it was definitely about... I wanted to combine high-end design and taste with building motorcycles, right? And to a degree, there were at that point, I didn't know of any custom motorcycle builder or motorcycle shop or anything like that I thought combined sort of a tasteful cultural experience along with tasteful art and graphics. And, you know, like, if, let's face it, a motorcycle company isn't much unless it's a brand. Right. You can build all the motorcycles you want and call them Motorcycle A, and no one's really going to give a damn until that develops into a brand ethos. And so you could have Motorcycle A. If it was the coolest damn motorcycle in the world, that would then be a brand. Right. And then you have to back that up with events and cultural iconic images and content, all sorts of things to really turn that into something. So, when I started, the vision was, yeah, I want to build a brand. But what is that brand going to be? It changed and evolved rapidly. But, you know, when I discovered, for instance, when I discovered Deus Ex Machina, which was 3 years after I'd started, I was so, so mortified because, like, great, someone else figured this out, that if you combine great taste and great art with the motorcycle culture and content, you know, someone else got it and they beat me to it. And then, you know, I'd get over that. And then they, like, moved to the U.S. and I was like, oh, God. And then I met those guys and realized, you know, actually, I'm going off a bit, but in truth, the part that has been the most powerful to help me move forward through the steps was meeting people that I thought were either superheroes or 3,000 light years ahead of me, and then finding out that, in fact, they just had different situations, right? They'd started a slight bit before me. It wasn't that they were superheroes. They were just normal guys like me who were just a few steps ahead. That's all.
So how confident were you in your abilities back then, though? I mean, how did you establish a reputation and actually build the brand?
Up to that point in my life, there was nothing that I had really, really tried to do that I wasn't able to complete. I don't think a lot of people can say that with a straight face. But, you know, whatever I really applied myself to, I got done, right? Except for relationships. That was impossible, right? You couldn't navigate. you couldn't make a relationship work out, but you could make a thing happen, right? Whether it be a challenge of education or mechanical thing. There was control you had over that. And you can even control how many times you get knocked down in anything and continue to stand up. You can control that. And so essentially being determined to keep trying until, and be tenacious to keep trying until something hit was my only real skill. And I had confidence in that.
So how did you teach yourself the skills in the first place to get going?
To be fair, you have to understand that I've always been technical. I've always been decent with machines. I definitely understand machines and I understand how they work and the engineering behind them. My father's a very technical person and some of that carried into me. And I when I was younger, not only fixing the broken motorcycles and broken things that I was given, but restoring old muscle cars with my dad and rebuilding engines and everything from the lawnmower to, you know, a race car really gave me confidence that I could conquer things. But I realized early on that I wasn't going to be a technical, genius. That wasn't going to happen. So in 2010, 2011, I took on a business partner who was an engineer, a mechanical engineer, and a gifted one at that, and relied on his technical expertise while he relied on my visual design expertise, right? So I've always had a natural understanding. You know, it's always subjective or objective. It's always up to the user, but I've always had a sense of what was beautiful and what wasn't, right? And yeah, that skill is either in you or it isn't, I think, right? And that was something I just continued to try to build confidence in and competency in and a technical understanding to a degree. But really, I'm definitely not a classically trained designer. So my expertise, without saying expertise, I hate saying that, it was design, was seeing, I used to say shit from Shinola, seeing the good from the bad. And if you could do that, that's still a skill that not everybody has.
And I guess it depends who you're talking to, but how would you describe yourself these days? Would you describe yourself as a designer or an engineer or an artist?
A designer, yeah. And, you know, I took on that name before I really thought that I was, if that makes sense, like, or that title, because it was my role in the company. In truth, in what I do on a day-to-day basis for the last 13 years, I design 2 or 3% of the time, and the other 97% of the time I'm running a business and running a company and trying to be strategic and fair and resolve conflict and issues and problems and whatnot. But what I'm working towards, I don't have an end goal. I have an end goal, and that is to continue to do something I love until I can't do it anymore. But my short-term goals and what I'm working towards right now is starting to come together, but that is letting someone else run the business and focusing on the creative aspects of projects and design, because that's what I really love. It's just easier said than done.
Yeah, not many people achieve that, but you've got to have the dream, haven't you? So I'm not going to ask you how many builds you've done, because it's never about quantity, of course, but would you say that there's a revival style that you've developed, like a signature that certain people in the scene could recognize?
I don't know that I'm qualified to answer that question because I'm too close to it. I hope there is. I've been told that there is, by people that I trust, that they see something, a common DNA in the things that I touch. But man, if you look at our body of work, to me, they're so widely varied that, you know, I would hope the only thing that ties them together is, an obvious care for the details of how things are executed. Yeah, I don't know. You'd be more qualified as an outsider to tell me than I would.
I'm not going to answer it either, but I am going to ask you a leading question, and I apologize for it. I'm going to ask you if you're a fan of the BMW brand, but first of all, I'm going to ask you what the first BMW build was that you did.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so yes, I'm a fan of the BMW brand, for sure. The first BMW build that we did actually never really saw the light of day. It did, but it didn't see the internet light of day. And maybe it did later. Actually, it did, by someone else. One of my first guys that came here to work with me built a really cool old BMW chopper. It's still on BikeXF, and it's shown on BikeXF. He built it, frankly, before he started here, and we helped him to improve that bike. It has our title on it. Very clearly in the article, it says that he made it before he started working for Revival. So I can't really claim that bike. I still think it's cool as hell, even though that guy didn't like me much anymore. I love that bike. And then we did another, like, BMW cafe style bike that's out there that also didn't really, we parted ways before that was even publicly seen because there were so many problems with building that bike. But I will say, you know, proudly, that the design of that bike and the direction of that bike was before the BMW custom thing in my mind really kicked off, right? That this was in 2011, probably 2012. And back just that long ago, 10 years ago, there weren't a lot of guys taking BMW bikes and turning them into customs. So we did that. We did a cafe style bike and we did a chopper style bike. And then, or, you know, he did. And then our first like BMW like custom was the Henne BMW, really, the one I will claim, which was inspired by the Henne bike. We did that in probably 2014 or something, maybe 15. And that's, I think, what got us on the radar of BMW corporate. They were like, oh, these guys like BMWs. And we did and do, and I have three or four BMWs. I've always been a fan of them. But we built that bike as an homage to the Henne Landspeed bike, and I'm still proud of the way it looks. It's in the Haas Museum in Dallas.
Was it an R100/7 that it was used as a base?
Yeah, to begin with, the motor was, yeah.
So, I mean, the idea that formed in your head, where did that come from?
Easy. I went to Wheels and Waves. Whatever year that was, I could look back and find out, like 2013 or 14. And I saw that bike in person, the bike that, you know, the ultimate evolution of what that bike became, sitting on some pallets, just very precariously fashioned, you know, like 3 or 4 feet off the ground, which is a good place to get a good level. I look at a bike. Among a bunch of crazy dancing Europeans at like 2 or 3 a.m. at night, and me going and getting the BMW guys and going, okay, we're pulling this thing out of the room because I'm so nervous someone's going to knock it over. Because I had reverence for that bike. Design-wise, it just was, I mean, one of the sexiest-looking racing bikes ever built. Like, so, so beautiful. And so it stuck in my brain. And then Mr. Haas approached me, probably a year later, and said he wanted to build his first custom motorcycle, like commission his first custom motorcycle. And I said, I really want to build an homage to that bike. And he said, okay, sounds good. He'd never heard of it, right? But he said, sounds fine. So we did. We built it. And in fact, I have the frame to build another one. I built two frames, but we never did. Anyway, my point is, it was easy. It was so beautiful. And I can't say we improved on it. We just kind of refined it. And we made the front end. We modernized the front suspension. And it's funny. If you were in my office, you'd know that there's only one bike there's only one photograph of one bike that I've ever built in my office, which is quite large. And it's that bike. That's the only one.
Yeah, I can understand why. It's beautiful to look at. And like you say, it got you in the attention of the Bods in Munich, and of course the birdcage that followed that. I want to come back to the birdcage in a minute, but I just wanted to touch on some of the other BM builds that you've done, because I recently saw a YouTube video of a beautiful R68 from the 1950s. I think you acquired it in an auction. Now that's a special and a rare bike. I've never seen it in real life. I've maybe seen one in the museum in Munich, but apart from that, only in books. So, but what I remember about that video you did about the restoration, and you gave it a lot of love and attention, but it was almost as if you felt a responsibility towards it. And then of course you test rode it, and you were genuinely amazed by its performance as well. So I think that bike probably had a special place in your heart too.
Yeah, I think to be a vintage motorcycle lover, like a real lover of vintage motorcycles, not because it makes you look cool or because it's a neat thing or nifty or whatever, you have to be a historian and you have to look at the context of the time in which something was made. And an R68 looks an awful lot like an R69S or, you know, even later model bikes, some of the /6s even. Like if you're not, you don't know what you're looking at, they look the same. But when you look at the time period of when that bike was made, how much earlier it really was, and if you ride a bike of that period, this is a refined timepiece, right? It is so, so smooth and performs so well, and has so much power, and the brakes work. I mean, the brakes work. That was a thing, right? At that point in time, to have the brakes work, slow the thing down, and feel confidence in that, that's a big thing. And then for it to still be beautiful and look like a sculpture, right? It doesn't look like an appliance at all. That bike is just heads and tails above so many machines for the period. But you have to have that context, right? Otherwise, it just looks like any of the other BMW vintage bikes that are sitting downstairs. And yeah, when I finally got the chance to ride it, now I spotted it at auction and told my client and friend, I was like, man, this, you're not a lot of these come up. And then we got a deal on that bike. It was so inexpensive because you can't, you know, at an auction, you can't start a motorcycle. You don't know how well it's been fettled. You really have no idea. But we brought it back, and immediately it ran, right? And it started up, and we got a good deal on it, and then spent quite a bit of money and time to make it almost perfect. It's still around. It's still sitting just a few miles from here. And then riding it was almost transcendental. I really should have devoted more time and taken it off on location to ride it for that video, and maybe I will do a second video at some point. But, yeah, sorry, I gush about it because it's a kick-ass motorcycle.
No, you don't see them really at shows, exhibitions, and you certainly don't see people riding them. So I'm wondering if people are hiding them. I know there weren't that many produced in the first place, were there? So,
no, I think, I can't remember now, but is it 1,000 or no? It's not that many. It's not that many. It's less than that. But to know that that machine would go 100 miles an hour, like, that's mind blowing. And look that good. That's the part I still can't get over. The cases, the tank, the bodywork, the fenders, every single thing on it. It's so precisely designed and put together. You have to remember that it was done with a piece of paper and a slide rule and experience and excellence in fabrication, not with a computer where it's so easy to get those details right. I say so easy. It's still difficult, but you understand what I mean. Like, to come up with a cohesive design is so much easier in a computer than it is with talent, where raw talent.
And 70-odd years ago as well, eh? Yeah. So sticking on the theme of performance just a minute, what was the inspiration for that S1000RR that you did a few years ago? Because that was dressed up in, you know, like old-school endurance-style bodywork. I really like that.
Like anything you create or, you know, or a part of creating, you look at it and you see immediately the parts you regret that aren't right. But that bike was definitely inspired by an endurance bike in the, you know, I would say 70s, early 80s, that whole period. The tail section still bothers me. Now, understand the tail section, as far as its craftsmanship and the bodywork on it, it's still some of the best stuff we've ever done. It's really tight. The body lines are solid. It is a really, really nice machine. But I wish that it hung down more, the tail section, to match the front, the bulbousness of the front. But that's neither here nor there. I didn't design that part. I let that part go and then later regretted that it didn't flow with it cohesively. But yes, that bike we built to go endurance racing with Kevin Schwantz, of all people. And by the time we got it done, Kevin had some stuff with Suzuki and couldn't technically go on the track, and we still take it to the track. I've got a track day in a few weeks with that bike. So it was, you know, we rode it on the street, and I've got a great story about how it was broken in by Schwantz at the racetrack with us. But there was just an inspiration to take something that looks like I don't know. That thing looks like an AR assault rifle, right? It's just so brutal. And although I love it, I know Ola, I love the way that bike looks from a modern perspective. It lacked some beauty, in my opinion. And I wanted it to be a little less like a machine gun, a little more like a beautiful sculpture, right? So we designed this aluminum bodywork. The best part about that bike, man, is taking it to the track on track days and having all the BMW guys second look, but they're not sure exactly what it is, or pass them on the racetrack on this thing that you, by the sound of it, you're like, oh, something's different about this motorcycle because it's open pipe, right? But still, what an amazing scalpel of a machine on the racetrack.
And what a talking point at the end of that first session when everyone sort of gets off their bikes and kind of like pulls off their helmets. And I guess that they start wandering over then, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. At Circuit of the Americas, there's, you know, on a track day there, there's probably like 300-400 motorcycles, and all of them are modern sport bikes. Every single thing. There's like one vintage two-stroke bike there. Right? Everything else is modern motorcycle because they're the best. And then this thing rocks up. and every as you come through the to the pit lane, right, everyone's just like this, just looking at it like, what are these guys are crazy. But then you ride it, or then you get out there, and it, yeah, it's doing 180 just like everybody else.
Yeah, yeah, brave move to do it with the double R, absolutely. So
it's fun. That was a great project. BMW supported that project and just let us have carte blanche, do what we wanted. So I'm so pleased to still have it here.
So the builds you do, are they always for clients, or do you keep some of them for yourselves, you know, for display at events?
Yeah, some of them stay here. Some of them stay here. I've been lucky enough to buy back one of the first original bikes that we built from the client, because his tastes changed, or his enthusiasm changed. It took us so long to make it at the beginning. But the rest of all the major custom builds have gone to either the manufacturer that commissioned the build or the client. Yeah, there's plenty of motorcycles here that we've made for ourselves, but those always get kind of like a 10% effort, because we can't afford. Frankly, I still can't afford to build one of the motorcycles that I built for clients. So someday.
And how many have you got currently in the workshop then?
Probably over 100.
Yeah. And how many of those are projects sort of still waiting to be started?
Well, you know, there's degrees of project, right? So probably only 4 or 5 that are like significant builds. Actually, maybe it's 3 or 4. And 30 to 40, maybe, you know, 30 to 40 other projects, like smaller level projects. We're now much better about telling people that it's going to be a year or two before we even touch it. You know, finding the right talent with the right attitude that makes this still fun, right? Because this is fun. Building motorcycles is fun, is a difficult thing. You know, and the company's ebbed and flowed over the years. My enthusiasm has not wavered for motorcycles and building motorcycles. But right now, we just hired another guy as a fabricator who we're really excited about, and who's kind of fresh. But, you know, I'm less concerned with building custom motorcycles and more concerned with helping other people to do so at this point. That's been my focus, is encouraging and inspiring other people to recognize that I'm a normal guy. Everyone's ever worked here is a normal guy. You can build motorcycles too. You can customize bikes. You can even learn how to machine and weld and metal shape. You can do all those things. You just have to be tenacious, and you have to be determined, and take your wins incrementally as you work through the process. And you can do it too, and find the same joy in it. So our business has evolved into more supporting other builders with tech support and selling them the right parts. Than anything else, and trying to do more content and DIY videos, but that's, as you probably know, easier to say than it is to do.
Do you take on apprentices? And, you know, what a cool apprenticeship that would be to have, right? You know?
So what a day for you to ask that question. My first, he's not an apprentice. We can't really afford apprentices. By that I mean, I don't like to have anybody here for free. Right, because if they're typically if someone's not getting paid, then they're going to behave like they're not getting paid. Right, it's hard for you to do that. But so we do have a guy that started today. He graduated high school yesterday, and he's working here today. Now, in truth, he's a friend of a friend, so he's got an inside scoop on how to get that done. But he's downstairs building wiring kits. Right, he's not building motorcycles yet. But I'd seen his driveway where he was building a custom car, and he has a BMW. He has an R100 BMW R/7 at 18, so he qualifies as an ambitious young man. So he gets to work here and maybe sweep floors for a few years. But no, we don't. We try to start with fresh people that have already got some talent in fabrication, or you know, of some type, and then encourage them, influence them, and foster them in. But that changes, man. It depends on the year you ask me that question. Right now, I'm putting my heart and soul into empowering someone who's got real promise, and we're hoping that he ends up doing his fulfilling his potential.
Yeah, fingers crossed for the new guy. That sounds brilliant.
Oh, it's great. It's great having an 18-year-old in the shop and seeing his eyes on his first job ever.
Just going back to that Henna BMW Landspeeder, and you mentioned earlier that you thought it maybe put you on the map, or, you know, kind of in front of the noses of some of our colleagues from Munich when that talk of big boxer prototypes began to surface. I just wanted to know a little bit more about the background story about how those initial conversations began that sort of led up to the Birdcage.
Yeah, I don't know if the stories I was fed were colored, you know, like if they were filled with anecdotes to make them slightly more entertaining. But I've probably added some color myself with over the years of my memory, but what I heard was it popped up on the internet. Someone at BMW went, what's this? Who are these guys in Texas? How are they capitalizing on our amazing history? And we're not, right? Why are we not showing this thing? Because it had been seen at Wheels and Ways, but man, the story of that bike wasn't, in my opinion, wasn't adequately told, right? And shared. And I think that got their attention, that we had managed to kind of garner some of the attention that bike deserved, and then said, well, maybe these guys will be competent enough to take this new thing that we're investing, you know, millions of dollars in all this time, and turn it into something, a new vision, right? And so, yeah, they came to us years before, but they couldn't tell me anything. They couldn't say a thing. It was all shielded, you know? It was like, we're working on something cool. And it's like, well, who isn't working on something cool? But we think it's up your alley, so stand by. And then I waited a couple years, right? And then they came to us and said, okay, here's the deal. You know, you sign all these contracts and go through all this stuff to make sure you don't let the secret and the cat out of the bag. And it showed up, you know. Actually, the CAD rendering showed up before the motorcycle or before the parts and pieces of it did. And immediately there was the challenge, which was, you know, how do I sink my teeth into this creatively and turn it into something I'm proud of? And yeah, there's a long story that could take 30 minutes to go further than that.
That's the problem with that. I just knew with this podcast, we'd just be scratching the surface. So we're going to have to come back for parts 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. But did you have 100% creative freedom of this for the Revival Birdcage, or were there constraints, you know?
Legally speaking, I had creative freedom, right? The only thing that they requested was that I wasn't going to build anything that looked like the factory motorcycle, which was fair, fine. I didn't want to build anything that looked like that. So it was the excuse I needed to pull the plug on the factory design. And then I started to build something with a supercharger on it. And they asked for an update, and they found out I was going to put a supercharger on it. They weren't huge fans of that. At least that's what trickled down to me. So change course. Well, I was already months into, if not year into, that design, you know. And for me, there always has to be a centerpiece of anything you're going to do. There has to be one hook that lets you go, oh, this is a different application, or this is a different material, or this shape is new. There has to be something, right? And for me, the hook was going to be the supercharger, because the original Hinne bike that I had built had a supercharger, and or at least eventually did. And that iteration with the supercharger, to me, was the sexiest one of the bunch. So I wanted to take the Hinne concept, inspired by Hinne, build another motorcycle with that configuration, because obviously the flat twin was the same, but bigger, and turn it into something with like 200 and something horsepower. But I, you know, they didn't like that. And I'll be honest, I think it would have been harder to build that motorcycle anyway, the way I wanted to do it. So I had to reassess. And so I, like any good designer, I procrastinated for 7 weeks, right? While staring at what I was going to be, trying to decide what it could be instead. Right. And then, yeah, late one night I had two, cocktails. It was a Friday night in the workshop by myself, with really loud music and really dramatic lighting. A true story. A friend was upstairs sleeping on the couch in the workshop, and I woke him up after I'd come up with the concept to come downstairs and look at what I'd done. And he said, "It's great. You got it. It's perfect, right?" But 2 or 3 hours of him sleeping on my couch, I was in a zone. I got into the zone and came up with an idea that turned into the Birdcage.
Was it the first time you'd worked with titanium, or?
Yeah, we'd never touched titanium before. Obviously, I understand the metallurgy to a degree, and it's lighter and strong and blah, blah, blah. But no, I'd seen birdcage, you know, frames in the Porsche and the Maserati, and I love that design element. It's so simple. I mean, it looks like a bridge. It doesn't look like anything. It's really difficult to make what ostensibly, yeah, is the triangulation of a bridge and trusses, and to make that elegant and beautiful. Right, so you're already fighting an uphill battle. So you have to use an interesting material with a great hue to it. Really, the color of titanium. After I anodized it and welded it, like, it looks beautiful. But to take that, to me, was a challenge worth accepting. Right, to try to turn a bridge into something beautiful and turn it into more sculptural, but also the element that if you can see through that, you know, the only assignment of the whole project with BMW was put this engine on display. Make this engine the centerpiece of the design. Well, to me, literal was make it so that it doesn't look like it has a frame. But so if you look at the birdcage, to me, if you don't see the beauty of the engine, it's because you're not looking. You can look right through the frame and see only the engine. And if you visually step back just a few inches, then you have a whole other thing to look at, which is the frame. They stand alone as separate things, even though they're clearly attached to one another. So I think it's a difficult trick to pull off, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's simplistic. I don't know. But we pulled it off, and I think it stands alone as something that most people thought, A, wasn't strong enough. It wasn't going to run. It can't function, and it's way overbuilt. It's perfectly adequately strong enough for anything I want to put on it. It rides beautifully, surprisingly. It rides really, really great. I took it to Jay Leno's a couple weeks ago, which isn't out yet, and let him see it, and he wanted to ride it. And I was like, man, I don't know if you're there's a lot going on on this motorcycle. It's built for me. The brake is on the left foot, right? The clutch is a hand clutch. It's a hand shift, and it's like it's not a simplistic machine to drive. Not to mention the seating arrangement of it, because it was made to go straight and fast, you know, for 2 miles, which is it's perfect for that. But yeah, I think the experience of it visually and the sound, I mean, it's the loudest motorcycle I've ever built. I think it came together. I'm really proud of it still. It's unfortunate that it didn't, because of COVID, it didn't get to go quite on the as many places it was going to go. It's about to leave here again to go to Goodwood.
There's a lot of people who still need to see it in the flesh. I mean, how long did your frame take to complete, and how many individual parts has it got on it?
You know, I used to know this number. I think it's over 400 welds. Right? It's 180-something pieces, I believe, of titanium. I can't remember now. It's been too long. And it took months. In truth, actually, let me back up. I think we built the bike in 7-8 weeks. Right? Now, we designed the motorcycle originally over the course of almost a year, right, as something else. And then when I had to reestablish a whole new thing, I already had points in space, meaning I knew where I wanted the neck to be, I knew where the wheels were going to be, I knew where the engine was going to sit. So I had it mocked up on the bench, floating in a jig, and it was like, okay, how do I connect these points to make this work out, right? How do I make all of this geometry come together and hold it together? Which is how any motorcycle is built, but, you know, how do you do it in a beautiful way? But I think, I'm pretty sure I could look back at my calendar, it was just 7.5 weeks of seven guys working as many hours as they could in a day, 7 days a week, right? And I told everybody, I'll give you a huge bonus, but we have to do this. The challenge has been set. The gauntlet's been thrown. We need this to be ready for a hand-built show. So we started on it. And yeah, one guy really did the bulk of the welding on the frame specifically. His one role in that team was to weld these pieces together. And he took 3 weeks at least to weld it. So, you know, and what is a reasonable amount of time, if it was a full-time gig, it would have taken months to do it. So, yeah, he did a great job. His name's Titanium. His name's Ty. I'd already called him Titanium, and he'd never welded titanium before. Then he started welding this, and now he's a titanium welding specialist, right? Like,
he's a master, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I love the way that you just could not ignore that beautiful frame, but somehow, as you were saying earlier, you could just see right through it to reveal that huge engine, gearbox, and drive. But what I really want to know is who saw the finished version of the birdcage first from BMW, and what was their reaction?
Timo and a few of his people were the first ones to see it, right? And I thought I saw Timo tear up, but I can't say for sure. I know that he was emotionally affected by it, but yeah. So to finish the whole story about the birdcage, remember they said you know you can't do the supercharger. Well, then I didn't show anybody anything after that. I was like, all right, well, I'm not showing anything else because I have to pick a point and I have to go with it. And I was afraid they weren't going to like the telelever suspension, which is an obvious throwback to a different time with BMW, but they still use a telelever. So to me, that was modernizing this vintage thing. And it worked out perfectly with the birdcage idea, which was Chris Auerbach is our head engineer. And it was his idea to do the telelever to make it work. And I was like, ah, it's perfect, right? It made it happen. So yeah, I think Timo was the first one to see it. It was the day before Hand-Built Show started. We had this press junket here, and it's not like I had a, you know, blanket over it or anything. Like, it wasn't some big reveal. It was just, let's walk inside, and here's the motorcycle. And Yeah, he was blown away. He was pretty excited.
And of course, you always knew that the R18 was coming. So as an American, do you feel that BMW has hit the right spot with the production bike? I mean, it's such a big market, of course, but not an easy one to break into.
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers speak for themselves. You know, yeah, there's been some COVID has made some pretty significant changes in the demand for motorcycles, right? In general, motorcycles are in more demand, but they sold them, you know, they sold all they could, right? All they could make. So I think they hit the mark, and I think that it's sold well. I think if BMW's happy with it, you know, it doesn't even matter. But yeah, anybody that rides it, that rides cruiser motorcycles, is saying the same thing, which is, hey, this thing feels perfect. And it's a BMW. It may sound cliche, but it's cliche for a reason, because it's true. They make fantastic machines.
And have any of your clients asked you to do a revival interpretation of their own R18s yet? Or could you see that happening?
I can see it happening. It hasn't happened yet. You know, there are not enough of them on the road yet, perhaps, but what does it take? It just takes the right amount of crazy person to take this wonderful motorcycle that's really well done and decide he wants to ruin it by having me customize it. I'll do it. Sure, why not?
So you mentioned that the Birdcage was unveiled, if you like, at the Handbuilt Motorcycle Show, and I think the production version should have also been unveiled for the first time at last year's Handbuilt Show, but of course COVID scuppered those plans, didn't it? But I believe the show's going to be back in 2021, so can you tell us about why you started the show concept and how it's developed over the years?
Handbuilt Show was something I actually conceived of long before Revival, right? I wasn't planning to enter the motorcycle business in any way, shape, or form, but I've been to a few motorcycle events, and, you know, I saw potential, let's just say. Yes, I was happy to be at a motorcycle show and to see vintage bikes and such, but I just thought it could be done better, and it could be more inviting to outsiders, right? That was my main thought. So in like back in the early 2000s, when I got back into vintage motorcycles, which was 2004, I wanted to make a show. Then once I had a business and was entered the business, flash forward to, you know, forward like 10 years, then I was like, well, maybe I should, you know, maybe I should have an event. And it started off as, well, you know, Austin's not a mecca of motorcycles or of cars at all, frankly. And when Circuit of the Americas was announced that they were going to build this world-class Formula One and MotoGP track, it was amazing, right? I actually thought it was a joke for a couple months that wasn't real. But as soon as I heard MotoGP was coming to town, I was like, all right, I'm going to launch an event. I'm going to do it MotoGP weekend. I'll have an international crowd of motorcycle lovers here. Let's introduce them to what, you know, the custom scene is like, whether it be garage builders or professional builders. Let's put them all into one room. And that was it. That was the conception. The first year, I partnered with some guys from out of town, and it did not go well at all. Yes, everyone showed up. It was a neat thing, but it was way more work than what it needed to be, and it wasn't the polished event I wanted it to be for the public. So this following year, when we went our own, decided we'd do it our way. The response was that people were inspired and that families were coming and that it was hitting people that weren't part of the motorcycle scene and really seeing these things as the art and creative pieces that they were. And it's just developed from there.
I wanted to ask you, because, I mean, it's your vision that the visitors to the Handbuilt Motorcycle Show will be inspired to pick up tools and use their hands to make something of their own. So do you ever hear stories of this having happened? And have you ever seen any of the results?
Yes. Yeah. Really satisfying. Yeah. There have been a few guys, even kids, like young people that have come to the show, never even considered that this is something they would be interested in or try or that they could do, and then done it. Right. And brought back cool custom, like small bikes, typically, right? Their first bikes. But then several, now one of them has done, I think, three since then. And he's continued to bring back bikes every year. Man, one of those makes all of this worth it. And I'm not trying to be, you know, dramatic. Like, literally, feeling that I played a role in someone finding something new and creative and satisfying for them in any way, shape, or form. Like, our team inspiring them to do that is really. It's powerful, it's satisfying, and it's helping keep us here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, apart from the show itself, what would you say is the best way for motorcycling fans to dip their toe into the world of customization? Because, I mean, where on earth do you start? From the outside, it can be seen as a little bit intimidating and maybe full of experts, but it is really one of the friendliest scenes out there, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think I think the only way to start is to look at your motorcycle and think about how you would improve it, right? And whatever that means to you, it could be that you want a sheepskin seat. That's your improvement. I don't know. Like, it doesn't really matter. If you want to paint the wheels white, whatever it is you want to do, like, there is something you can do to your machine that makes it better in your eyes. And that means that it's better, right? It doesn't have to be better by other people's standards. And it doesn't have to be complex. It doesn't have to be, you know, using a machine to make the pieces to do it. It could just be buying aftermarket pieces or updating the things about it that you see is lacking. And, you know, from a factory correct machine, it's something that's come straight off the factory line. Bikes like the R18 are so good off the line. It's hard to imagine, right, without a significant commitment, improving that design. But if you're looking at bikes in the 70s, 80s, 90s, there's so much about those bikes that was a compromise in not only their mechanical and technical design and build, but even aesthetically, right? There's so many things about them to change that it's easy to start there and improve something like that and then get a new bike so you can just ride that one while you're working on the other one. But yeah, I think the way to start is just look at what you think you could improve little by little and step your way into to more and more complex projects.
Yeah. You strike me as someone who really loves and lives for what they do. So could you see yourself ever doing anything else, or have you got enough projects to last this lifetime and the next?
I'll be honest, I'm always thinking about what I'm going to do next, right? So I hope that I never, ever have to leave Revival and Handbuilt and all that. I hope I'm always a part of this world. But I am contemplating more design projects for larger markets. And I don't mean just so I can make more money. I mean that once you get the taste of satisfaction of designing something for a niche market, I like to say that Revival is a niche of a niche of a niche, right? Like, we're maybe well known in the motorcycle world, but that's in the custom part of the motorcycle world that is of this genre, that is of this make, that is like, it's still pretty esoteric and strange, right? We're eccentric bunch of dudes, but maybe we do neat things, but only when it's recognized. Like, when I go in public and I go to places when I'm not wearing a Handbuilt show shirt and someone knows who I am, you know that guy's a nerd, right? You automatically know this guy. This guy is a true nerd for this thing. And then you're like, oh gosh, here it goes. I'm going to have to lay into this conversation, because if they know me, that means that they're really in it. But I'd like to work on things that are a little more generic. I'd like to design things that more people can appreciate, right? That, yes, you might be able to look at a motorcycle and see it's cool and you like it, but I want you to be able to own a piece of something that I've had an influence in designing and building. So I'm always thinking about that, to be honest. That isn't some big announcement that's coming or anything like that. I'm not teasing. It's that my brain is always thinking about design and architecture and fabrication, always.
There's no shut-off switch. No engine shut-off.
None. Yeah, it takes a lot for me to turn that off.
Absolutely. Alan, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. And sorry that we've only scratched the surface of just a few of the builds that Revival has done. But fortunately, you are very good at documenting these and sharing the background stories with the community. So where's the best place that people can find out more details about what you're up to, basically?
Yeah, you could just go to our website, revivalcycles.com. You can also go to our YouTube channel that gives you a bit more of a glimpse into what we are, which is just Revival Cycles on YouTube. Our Instagram accounts for Handbuilt Show and for Revival Cycles are super easy to find, and they give you a bit more of a glimpse. One of the things I've always tried to focus on is sharing the backside, right? There is no magic here. I want you to see all of it and see the trials, tribulations, the mistakes, all of it. So yeah, the YouTube channel is something I'm really working on with the team right now to take the initiative to share more DIY, more instructional videos, and then of course just more about the projects we're working on. But yeah, YouTube and the website you'll find lots of things, and we're working on a whole new site that kind of puts that together in a more cohesive and smooth way.
Get that 18-year-old apprentice on the case with his camera and editing skills and make it happen. Absolutely. That's great.
I hired a veteran. I hired a 25-year-old web guy. You know, he's been around the block a few times.
Ancient. Positively ancient.
Yeah, old guy.
Superb. Well, listen, thanks once again for chatting with us, Alan. We look forward to the next creations from Revival. Bye for now.
All right. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Alan. Great to hear some of those background stories and to learn that physical craftsmanship, skill, ingenuity, and creative design –
is well and truly alive and kicking within the Revival workshops. I don't have any exes that live in Texas, but I've sure got to get myself down there anyway to visit one of your hand-built motorcycle shows. And as for you listeners, let us know if you've been inspired to create and craft your own hand-built BMW. Perhaps we could feature your build on a future episode of Ride and Talk. Bye for now.